produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today, Missoula, Montana voters to decide marijuana deprioritization initiative. Missoula election officials confirmed last week that a municipal initiative that seeks to make marijuana law enforcement the city's, quote, lowest priority, close quote, has been certified to appear on the November 2006 ballot. Sponsored by Citizens for Responsible Crime Policy, Initiative 2 directs municipal police to make activities related to the investigation, citation, and or arrest of adult cannabis users their lowest priority. It would also appoint a community oversight committee to monitor police activity as it pertains to marijuana law enforcement. The committee would consist of community members, criminal defense attorneys, and a drug rehabilitation counselor who would investigate marijuana arrests and produce a report on the initiative's effects 7 months after its passage. The measure would not define marijuana sales or use by minors as low priority offenses and would not legalize marijuana. Sponsors of the initiative modeled their proposal after a successful 2003 Seattle proposal, which has led to a 75% reduction in citywide marijuana arrests. Voters in Santa Cruz, Santa Barbara, and Santa Monica will vote on similar municipal initiatives this fall. Voters in three states, Colorado, Nevada, and South Dakota, will also vote on statewide cannabis liberalization initiatives this fall. We have links to all these initiatives at normalaudiostash.com.
If I were to tell you that in America, right now, over 1 million children sell marijuana, what would you think? Would you think that any public policy that creates over 1 million teenage marijuana dealers needs to be reexamined and possibly amended? You would not be alone. The members of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, a.k.a. NORMAL, have been working since 1970 to reform marijuana laws such that responsible adults, not children, sell and use marijuana. Isn't it high time to reform America's misguided marijuana laws? This is Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORMAL in Washington, D.C. Only concerned citizens can effectively end the federal government's nearly 70-year-old prohibition on responsible adult marijuana sales and use. Want to know more about how you can help? Contact us at NORMAL, toll-free, 888-67-NORMAL, or by visiting the organization's popular and informative webpage at normal.org.
Welcome back to the Audio Stash on this fine Wednesday. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at NORMAL to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit normal.org. Today on the Audio Stash, we have a special feature interview all about drug testing. And stay tuned for our regular conversation with Dr. Mitch Earlywine later in the show. Random drug testing in the workplace and schools has become a part of American society, even as serious questions remain as to their effectiveness and role. Joining us today to talk about these trends and technologies is Jenny Kern of the Drug Policy Alliance. She's the campaign coordinator of the Drug Testing Fails campaign. Jenny, welcome to the Audio Stash today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting me to be here.
Jenny, Paul Armentano, Normal's senior policy analyst, recently mentioned that you attended a conference and expo of the companies that perform drug testing. Tell us a little bit about that conference and the companies that were there.
Well, it was an industry-wide conference, so it was all the movers and shakers in the drug testing industry. One particular company I recognized was there, had presented at all of the Office of National Drug Control Policy conferences on student drug testing, and that was Southwest Laboratories. So it kind of, there was an overlay between the push for student drug testing by the industry, and it was kind of an internal industry conference. So Paul had recommended it to me. I followed up to learn more about drug testing more generally after working on student drug testing so much. But also, it really is an industry conference, so that you'll get a lot of really frank information about the limitations of the technology and kind of what are the marketing strategies or where they're trying to go next.
This is slightly humorous for me to imagine, all the drug testing companies in a modern expo with booths and everything. How do these companies exhibit their wares?
Well, there are, you know, there's a lot of free samples of drug tests, and they do. They set up all the booths, and they'll tell you all about all the various different devices from, you know, oral fluid testing and urine testing and hair testing, and so they're all set up there, and you know, it's kind of a, you know, it's a show. And but if you go up and ask, you know, the presenters, they'll be really frank with you about the limitations of technology. So for instance, oral fluid testing, which they're using in some schools, drug testing has a really short window of detection. So for instance, marijuana, the window of detection is only about 4 to 8 hours, perhaps even less, maybe even 1 to 2 hours, I've heard. So, and it only detects mostly for the metabolites, so not the parent drug of marijuana. So it's not very sensitive at all. So in a lot of schools that are conducting random drug testing, they'll say, oh, you know, we haven't had positive results, this is such a success, whereas really it's just a false sense of security because they're really not picking up on what's going on with this kind of technology. So that's just one example.
You mentioned the marketing a moment ago. How do these companies market themselves and grow their business?
When the Supreme Court decision came down, unfortunately, allowing these policies of random student drug testing, the drug testing industry was all abuzz. They saw it as a new niche market. And they really, you know, a lot of When proposals are proposed at school boards, often drug testing companies will volunteer and come in and tell them how their technology is 100% accurate and, you know, they'll never have false positives, which isn't true. The technology is actually fairly limited, especially when you're doing kind of point of collection tests, which are, you know, the dipstick tests that they do it in initial screens in schools. And those tests are very shaky. And then they'll have to do follow-up tests. So what they really do push very hard. They have a lobby branch in Washington that's trying to push the expansion of drug testing. So they're really active, and it's big money, big business.
Jenny, let's talk about the technology a bit here and start with the most common drug screening method. How is the modern test done, and is it accurate?
I would say we probably know the most about urinalysis compared to the other technologies because it's the one that's been around the longest. But you can't really make any broad sweeping statements about it because every drug testing company, you know, has different protocols. And one thing I learned at this industry conference is that it's a highly unregulated industry. So there are some laboratories that are SAMHSA certified, so that's for federal workplace drug testing, but there's only 48 of them in the whole country, so not even one per state. And they have probably the highest regulations and safeguards. But a lot of drug testing companies have no regulation or oversight whatsoever. And these are companies that, you know, review drug tests where the results will determine, you know, parental rights in courts or student drug testing. There's no required oversight whatsoever. So just in casual conversation over lunch with a drug tester who was just trying to learn more, she was telling me that her company was trying to save money, so they really tried to be very sparing with the confirmation test. And she said that a lot of the people administering the test don't know what they're doing, and also that she was in one situation where she demanded that they do a follow-up confirmation test, and if she hadn't demanded that, this woman would have lost her parental rights. And so there was some, you know, really frank discussion about, you know, the lack of regulation in the industry and kind of these horror stories that can come out of it. So it's kind of a scary issue.
Also growing in use is the hair testing technology, but we've heard about the wide inaccuracies, especially with darker hair color.
Yeah, that's true. We were involved in some conversations about a suit that's going on in Boston where African-American police officers were fired due to hair tests. And the science out there is fairly strong that people with darker colored hair, and of course it follows a lot of the racial biases, unfortunately, that are in our country, will retain the traces of drugs or the metabolites in the hair, whereas people with lighter colored hair, you know, blonde or lighter colored hair, will not. So it follows that African Americans are more likely to test positive than Caucasians, just due to the internal biases in the testing technology. And in fact, at this conference, they said that, you know, if you have gray hair, you know, they can't detect any drugs at all. So that was just kind of interesting.
It's certainly ironic when it comes to hair testing. People tout it as being less invasive, and it may seem so on the surface, but the results of hair tests look much further back into your personal history.
That's true. It's about a 90-day window, and it won't give recent use. So it's longer term, but it won't give recent use. And it is also one of these technologies that hasn't been approved for federal workplace testing. So there are guidelines underway to try to approve this, but it hasn't been approved. So it really is kind of one of these technologies that isn't very well regulated. We don't really know exactly what's going on there. So it really hasn't passed that test yet.
Jenny, let's talk about these home testing kits being marketed to parents. First, what's the most common type being sold out there?
Probably a urine test. I don't really know the brand names. But there has been a big push for these testing kits, and this is a great example of kind of the industry pushing for new markets. What has happened in some schools is, you know, drug testing industries will go to the schools and say, you know, this is a great technology, parents can use it at home. So there's been a real push at school, and then also on behalf of the companies marketing to parents saying, you know, this is the answer, this will tell you whether, you know, your child is experimenting or using drugs. There has been research done on these companies that are promoting it. One such study was done at Children's Hospital Boston, and it reviewed internet-based home drug testing products for parents. So they were marketing towards parents. And they found that the companies didn't adequately educate parents about the limitations of drug tests and the technical challenges of administering the drug test themselves. So this includes the parents going through collection procedures. There's also the potential for misinterpreting results. There's also false positives and false negatives. And also, the sites go into any of the potential negative consequences on the parent-child relationship and some real damage that can be done there.
Now that parental relationship issue certainly is real when you have to ask your teenager to supply a urine sample. So let's assume a parent follows all the procedures for a home drug test. How accurate are they?
Well, a lot of the tests, they are not all to send in, and that's scary in itself. So a lot of them are just those initial point of collection tests, which are not very accurate at all. If you do, you know, send it into a laboratory, it will depend on, you know, if you did everything right and what the standards of the laboratory are. And also for interpreting those results, I don't know what kind of resources are available for parents in terms of if the child's on prescription medications, if they're eating certain food products. There's a whole myriad of ways to go wrong here. And the obtaining the collection procedures, you know, aren't that easy. If you're doing your analysis, the best standards are to shut off all water in the area, put blue dye in the toilet, and then to actually visibly see, oversee the collection of the urine to make sure that adulterants or other attempts to cheat the test. But when it's a parent-child relationship, that can be really damaging to that relationship, and that might not be appropriate at all. So there's a lot that can go wrong there, and there's even more that can go wrong in the interpretation process.
Now, Jenny, let's talk about the overall here. Is random student drug testing at schools or parent-administered drug testing in the home, is this deterring young people from using drugs?
Well, the best science available out there says it's not effective. The only national federally funded study to date surveyed 94,000 students in 900 American schools with and without drug testing programs, and they found no difference in illegal drug use among students from both sets of schools. So the research out there does not support testing whatsoever. Based on anecdotal evidence, there's a lot of schools that have dropped drug testing programs because they saw that, for instance, they had the largest problem with alcohol use. And student drug testing does not address alcohol, which is the most dangerous and most commonly used substance among young people. Alcohol leaves your system so quickly, a drink per hour, that this whole random testing process really isn't going to detect anyone unless, you know, they're drinking at school, which sometimes unfortunately does happen, but you would hope, you know, that teachers would be aware enough to pick up on that without needing a drug test.
So one final question for you today, Jenny. If you're a parent and your school has or is planning to implement random student drug testing and you don't like it, what should you do?
We have developed a website as a resource to parents to try to be really active, go to your school board meetings, write to the school, organize with other parents. And our website is www.drugtestingfails.org. And we put together a booklet with all the available arguments and research out there. And there is a whole slew of actionable items on the website. And it really, parents just need to get involved, be vocal. A lot of parents are just, you know, afraid to speak up, but it really is a very salient issue. It really goes to the heart of kind of your freedoms and, you know, what kind of society we're going to raise our children in. And there's a lot of public health experts who strongly oppose random drug testing too. So the efficacy, it just doesn't work. And then in terms of a public health issue, it really doesn't help.
Jenny Kern is coordinator for the Drug Policy Alliance Drug Testing Fails campaign. Jenny, thanks for joining us here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Thank you so much, Chris.
We have links to the Drug Testing Fails website and more information on drug testing from Normal at normalaudiostash.com.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Where will you find the executive director of Normal at 420 on most days? Nah, he will not likely be imbibing in the sacred herb, but he will be tuning into the next Normal Audio Stash for important news and information concerning marijuana. This is Normal's executive director, Alan St. Pierre, in Washington, D.C., and And if you've got a phone line and a computer, then you too can make a daily cannabis connection with Normal's popular daily audio stash podcast. Normal is growing the truth about cannabis, and the harvest is yours to reap. Tune in every day at 4:20 p.m. for your daily audio stash. Get hooked up with Normal's daily and weekly news podcast by visiting norml.org or normalaudiostash.com.
Next up today, it's time to check in with the science of cannabis with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Earlywine is author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and joins us each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash. Mitch, welcome back to the program today.
Great to be back.
Last week we touched on teenagers and cannabis use. Let's explore that in more detail today. So what happens in the brain of someone under 18 when they smoke cannabis?
As it turns out, cannabis can interfere with proper brain development if it's used early on in life. So data suggests that people who start smoking marijuana before age 18 have different brain structures from folks who smoke comparable amounts but don't start until after age 18. And in fact, I would suggest that waiting to age 21 to start using cannabis is not a bad idea at all.
Now, what kind of side effects are there? Are they visible detriments?
These aren't huge detriments. You wouldn't be able to pick them up without an MRI scan of the brain. But in fact, what shows up is a different proportion of white and gray matter. As you know, some of the brain is gray and other parts are white, and that proportion of gray to white is very important for how fast your brain can conduct messages and get information from one part of the brain to the other. And if that proportion gets out of whack, it can be problematic later in life, and that seems to be what happens with folks who use cannabis before their brains are completely developed.
So we mentioned this last week as well. One should likely wait until age 21 to regularly smoke cannabis. This isn't part of some mindless Just Say No campaign, but really the science of personal optimum health.
In fact, anybody who values their brain and their intellect should think about, putting cannabis consumption off until later in life. The data on marijuana dependence also suggests that the later you start using cannabis, the much less likely you are to ever get any dependent symptoms for cannabis. So again, I think this is a substance that adults should be able to use freely, but teens should really be discouraged from using at least until later on.
And Mitch, we hear about this in the context of obesity. Habits we form as teenagers really become lifelong. And that can be tobacco, alcohol, food, or cannabis. So those teenage years are really important for parents to help teenagers form healthy habits.
I think the key, too, is to give them reasonable motivations for it. So rather than saying, hey, marijuana is going to make you psychotic or crazy or lose all motivation, which they can look around and see their friends and see that's really not the case, point out that, hey, I think you're a smart child, I love you, and I want to make sure your brain functions at its peak so you can have the neatest life possible. And then that's an explanation I think most teens can understand and would be much more willing to entertain the idea of delaying cannabis consumption rather than saying, hey, you can never touch this or I'll kill you.
Now, Mitch, in places that have more liberalized marijuana laws, say in California or in countries like the Netherlands, do teens use pot more often?
Karen O'Keefe and I did a big review of the data on medical marijuana states in the United States and teen use in those states, and it turns out it's really no different in those states from states that don't have medical cannabis laws. And I was very reassured by this because a lot of folks said, oh, medical marijuana sends the wrong message to teens, when in fact I think it sends a wonderful message to teens, and that's that we should do everything we can to help sick people. And it doesn't make them suddenly think, oh, gee, marijuana's okay, let's go try it, because it seems like their rates of use are the same as the teens in states that don't have medical marijuana laws. When you start looking across countries, obviously comparing the United States to the Netherlands is not an easy comparison. They're two very different places. But as far as policy is concerned, marijuana policy in the Netherlands is markedly less strict, and yet rates of teen consumption of all drugs are either comparable or lower in the Netherlands than they are in the United States. So the number of people who use hard drugs, the percentage of teens, is actually lower in some estimates in Amsterdam than it is here in the United States. And when you compare big cities like Amsterdam and San Francisco, which have actually, you know, very drastically different drug policies, you actually see more hard drug use in marijuana users in San Francisco than you do in Amsterdam. It's startling but true that if you take away some of this forbidden fruit and make marijuana less of a big deal, suddenly people are less interested in it.
And one more question today. We really have been talking about teenagers and recreational pot smoking, but what about minors who could perhaps benefit from medicinal cannabis? Even with some of these differences, could some minors with debilitating illnesses be able to use medicinal cannabis safely?
I'm not a physician, but physicians I've talked to about it say there's really an adult way to do it, if you will, and that's to really go to your physician, to really understand the substance, to really use the substance in a way that it's designed to minimize symptoms and problems, but doesn't turn into necessarily a recreational use. And for the, you know, the salient cases, there are drugs that are markedly worse, morphine, you know, some of the psychostimulants used for attention deficit and things like that, with a lot more negative consequences that we've been prescribing to children for years and years and really not had a horrible time with. I think medical cannabis for minors is a possibility. I wish that we could get more data on something like this, but in the current legal policy climate, it's going to be harder and harder to do. Yet I feel like this is a very promising substance for some disorders that are very common in minors. We ought to have that opportunity to investigate more.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is author of the book, Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. Mitch, thanks again for joining us here today on the Audio Stash.
Always a pleasure, and I'll talk to you soon.
Dr. Earlywine joins us each Wednesday here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash to discuss the science of cannabis. We have a special archive with all of our conversations. Just visit normalaudiostash.com.
Hi, this is Keith Strop, founder of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. When I founded the organization in 1970 to create a national discussion on the need to legalize marijuana for responsible adult use, no one honestly believed that 36 years later, marijuana would still be an illegal and untaxed commodity. However, since NORML began this important advocacy effort, 12 states have decriminalized the possession of marijuana, and 11 states have passed medical marijuana laws or voter initiatives, meaning that over one-third of the American population lives in a state or municipality that has reformed their marijuana laws. Isn't it time that Congress step in and pass national legislation to reform marijuana laws? Let's finish the job of legalizing marijuana once and for all by you and your like-minded friends joining and supporting NORML's long-standing advocacy. You can learn more about NORML's marijuana law reform efforts or become an active supporter by calling toll-free 888-67-NORMAL or by visiting www.normal.org.
Let's round out our Wednesday show with a laugh courtesy of podshow.com. Here's an irreverent little tune by The Fabrications. This is the Boy Scouts drinking song.
And we won't kiss boys. We build big fires and make lots of noise. We wear special knives and wear shorts with tall socks. Even get badges for knocking girls up. Hip hooray, Boy Scouts on the way. Hip hooray, Boy Scouts on the way. Hip hooray, Boy Scouts on the way. Witchy! Yay! We like to drink and we won't kiss boys. We build big fires and make lots of noise. We wear special knives and wear shorts with tall socks. Even get badges for knocking girls up. Hip hooray, Boy Scouts on the way. Hip hooray, Boy Scouts on the way.
That was the Boy Scouts drinking song by The Fabrications, Pod Save Comedy from podshow.com. This has been NORML's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to Paul Armentano, Dr. Mitch Earlywine, and Jenny Kern for contributing to today's show. Thanks to Podshow.com for all the great pod-safe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.